As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I thank you for joining us. I know there are many other things that you could be doing right now, like perhaps using a toilet brush on your bidet or perhaps getting caught up on other stuff. But no, with me in the studio today, I'm joined by Allison Rudd and the only living Gearbrandt in captivity. It's Mr. James Gearbrandt. And down the line, far more interesting than these two, is the man who, for charity, ran a marathon in a tutu. It's Matt Dickinson.
Hi, Gab. I've still got the tutu on. I'm wearing it all around the house. Got into it.
You English people and your strange fetishes. Now, you did it to raise money for charity, and I wanted to know if you had reached your goal. And
we did, thanks to the generosity of yourself and many people like you. Yes, to cut a long story short, a daughter of a very good close friend of mine died in September rowing, and in those circumstances you just rally around to do any tiny little thing you can to, well, show that you're thinking of them, I guess. And among many other things we're doing, did a run for the charity Momentum that look after families of people with sick or dying children, we raised 11 grand and counting. So yep, saw Mark Chapman from the BBC tweet that the marathon is just one of those things that shows the human race in a very good light, and it certainly felt like that yesterday.
Well, and I'm sure there's a Just Giving page that's still out there and open if you want to get involved. Now, we've got the PFA Player of the Year Awards to discuss. I'm sure we will go and mention how absolutely stupid this award is, given the format. We'll be looking ahead to the Champions League semifinals, maybe talking a tiny bit of Clásico, which I really enjoyed last night. But we start, of course, with the greatest cup competition in the world. Allison, Wembley, semifinals, Arsenal and City. I thought these two semifinals lived up to the hype. I watched them on the television apparatus, and I really enjoyed them.
Well, one was a lot better than the other. Come on.
Which one was better?
There was a classic. The Chelsea-Spurs game was a classic.
Yeah, but Arsenal and City, the drama, the fact that, you know...
The drama, as in all matches have drama... There was quite a lot of poor football in the Arsenal-City game. And it was stop-start, and just because it went to extra time does not make it a classic.
More interesting to me is Arsene Wenger changing things up, right? This is the guy who we've said he never changes, blah, blah, blah. He's got his philosophy, yak, yak, yak. If Stuart Robson were here, he'd say he lacks a defensive structure. James, he went 3 at the back. He dropped Bellerin, who y'all keep talking as if he's some kind of God's gift to football. He played a 3-4-2-1. This is, for him, this is pretty unusual, right?
I mean, it definitely is unusual because I think he played it in the league game before, hadn't he? But I think before that, he hadn't played a back three for like 20 years, I think. At the very least, you have to kind of say it shows a little bit of flexibility and the ability to kind of adapt to circumstance. Whether it will be a long-standing solution, I'm not sure is it a system that fits the squad particularly well at the moment. I don't know, but as a kind of stopgap, it's worked quite well for them.
Did it work in this game? I think when you consider City hit the woodwork twice, and obviously the disallowed goal, and we can blame the linesman, whose name is Child, by the way, as I discovered today, isn't it? Like, isn't his name like Steve Child? I mean, you've got wonderful names. I mean, there used to be a linesman called Roger Bone. I always thought of bone as a verb, actually, more than... But anyway, and now Steve Child. But It seems that a lot of the incidents went against City. Is that unfair?
Yeah, I think if you step back, although I was rather mean-spirited at the start, wasn't I, saying it wasn't a great game. I don't think it was, but I do think in terms of prettiness of the football and chances created, City could count themselves as unlucky, certainly. You have to then imply that that means that the key was not the Arsenal formation, the key was bad luck. But, I mean, I'm not surprised Wenger's gone for the back three, partly because it's in vogue, but partly he's, in press conferences, he has praised it as a formation that allows you to be more defensively structured and to sort of get stuck in a bit more, which is something, an accusation that's been levelled at Arsenal so much that you kind of think he has to have gone to bed at night thinking, how can I make people believe that my team are able to tackle and think defensively and put guts before flair? And if you play three at the back, you are just a bit more, the focus is more on your destructive players perhaps than your flair players. And they certainly seemed to take their impetus from the three at the back and play like they were going to be pragmatic, which, as we all know, isn't what Arsenal are very often. And in that sense, then they did deserve to win because they played the occasion and they played the opposition intelligently.
Where I'm sort of loath to suddenly start thinking Wenger has, you know, stumbled across, you know, the future or this is the answer is, I mean, you look at Oxlade-Chamberlain, who was one of their best performers. He played at right wing back. I mean, it was only a month ago that Wenger was talking about how, you know, central has always been where he's seen him, that, you know, this is, he needs to sort of stick to that and he needs to stay at Arsenal to learn. And we know Oxlade-Chamberlain is looking at a move to Liverpool, thinks there's a temptation to learn a lot more under a new manager because he has completely stalled at Arsenal for some seasons now. It's just careers just, you know, that had a lot of hope has just completely faltered. So suddenly he's throwing a wing back and say, performs admirably, but that's a complete change from what Wenger was talking about his best role being very recently. And the idea that suddenly, get off Arsenal's back, critics, I'm not buying that. I've sort of got to the point where I've seen enough completely sort of indefensible performances and just failure to do things like he did yesterday with a back three. I mean, I was at the Chelsea game at Stamford Bridge where they just sleepwalked into a defeat. I mean, they didn't try anything. They didn't try and do anything clever. So I've seen, we've seen more occasions where they haven't tried stuff to get too excited by this one yesterday just yet.
James, a lot of people will make a big deal out of the fact that Pep Guardiola will finish the season empty-handed. Does it matter? Does it change the way we see City's performance and City's development or possibly lack thereof this season? Is there a broader message there?
I think it kind of takes away the opportunity to kind of redeem this season because I think we're pretty much all in agreement that in terms of their league performance, it's been disappointing. They have not lived up to the level that we expected. To win a domestic trophy would have kind of redressed the balance a little bit. You could have said, okay, you know, it was a difficult season, but look, hey, they're early in the Pep project, and hey, you know, they did win the FA Cup as well. Now I think we're looking again at what seems to be quite a sort of, I don't want to say chronic, because it's only their first season, but it's certainly, you know, it's a kind of established pattern of Manchester City performing poorly against the teams that you would consider their competitors or, you know, the other big teams this season. I mean, I think,
even though they hit the woodwork and had the decisions go against them, and even though Pep says he's very happy with the performance, yeah, you're still not.
I think you could maybe excuse them if it was a one-off, but the pattern is so established. Like, I mean, I was at the game where they played Arsenal in the league, and again, you know, you could have said they were unlucky that day. By far the better side. They missed some good chances. I think, I can't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure they had a good penalty shout turned down. Out of the 11 times they've played the top seven in the league this season, they've only won two. Another defeat yesterday to Arsenal. I think once it happens so frequently, those excuses were a little thinner, I think.
Alisson, it's minute 9 of the first extra time period. It's 1-1. Sergio Aguero is tired or limping or whatever. He takes off Aguero and he takes off Fernandinho and he replaces them with Fabian Delph and Fernando and puts De Bruyne at center forward. Now, he had Iheanacho on the bench, and Iheanacho would come on a few minutes later for Raheem Sterling. But I thought to myself, that's really odd. Was this a situation where he's like, I'm going to be really clever again and surprise them by playing De Bruyne at center forward, which of course has worked so well in the past? Not. What was he thinking?
Oh, well, I think you've just given us a very nice, in a nutshell, example of why I personally just don't understand Pep Guardiola. I don't.
Ooh, are you going to say Fraudiola? Are you going to say
no,
that?
No, I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say it. But it does seem to, I know it sounds trite, and I know he's got an amazing track record, and I was a big fan too. But it just seems to me that he ignores, deliberately ignores the obvious, and he came in and he's put his philosophy above what the Premier League demands of you as a manager. James has gone through quite forensically and explained how disappointing the season has been when he's come up against particularly managers who are good at their job. He just doesn't seem to want to be the person that says, I have to adapt. I have to accept the opposition are strong in this particular area. I have to not play the way I want to play. Presumably, somewhere in his little book, he had this idea that maybe he wanted De Bruyne to be the key and he wasn't going to... I don't know. It didn't work. And it was a stupid thing to do. And I think everyone, like you, Gab, were thinking, oh, that's a bit peculiar. When you've got an out-and-out centre-forward on the bench, why are you doing that? It's because he's putting his thinking above the obvious, i.e. doing the obvious makes him look like a pretty average manager and he doesn't want people to think he does the obvious. There's something perverse about the way he approaches a lot of what he's done in his first season in English football, I would say.
I personally like the fact that he does things differently. And it would be really boring if everybody did everything the same all the time. I did not expect that it would take him this long to get his message across to his players. I did not expect him to have such basic decisions of squad management backfire, going all the way back to Hart and Bravo, going back to company's physical condition, to the dropping of Aguero, all this nonsense. But I'm really glad he's in the Premier League because we get to see him up close and it's a fascinating story. And you're seeing somebody who I think is extremely special go and work. And that means you're always going to get things right.
I think he's fascinating because, you know, clearly he's incredibly capable, Guardiola. And sometimes he makes decisions that you think, really? And then you see them unfold and you say, ah, that's why he's paid a lot of money to do the job he is. He's creative, finds creative solutions. But it has felt this season like he's throwing a lot of stuff around and not... maybe he's given himself the grace of a season of learning about players, learning about the league. Maybe he's thinking like, well, I will just sort of try this, try that. But I suspect he's expected better results from more of those experiments. I'm sure, given the standards he sets for himself, we know how obsessive he is. We know how hard he is on himself, how perfectionist he is. I'm sure he's pretty gutted by how the season has gone.
The other semi-final... Chelsea and Spurs. James, I'm sure as a child, which you were not that long ago, you were excited about FA Cup semifinals. In fact, your experience is probably different because when you were a kid, the FA Cup was not more important than the Premier League. Am I right?
No.
It was never a moment, right? Whereas for the rest of us, was there a moment when the FA Cup was more important than the Premier League, Alison?
No, it was, but that's partly because of what you could see on telly and you could see the FA Cup and they spent all day building it up. And you were made to think that it was the most important thing in the world.
So when Antonio Conte goes and drops Hazard and Costa, seems logical to you, right? Did it?
I'd have to say I was a bit surprised because his sort of apparently total lack of faith in Michy Batshuayi has been a real kind of theme of the season almost, to the point where, you know, he's sort of, even when Costa has been injured or suspended, he's played other people up front instead. So after I was quite surprised to see him play in such a big game. You know, if Conte was under scrutiny, people would be saying, oh, God, he got a bit lucky, you know, why didn't he start Hazard? But actually, having brought him on, he has the right for that decision to be seen as a good one, if you see what I mean.
Our friend and colleague Duncan Castles wrote this very eloquent piece where he absolutely destroyed Conte. Says he was found out after the United game. Was this actual tactical masterstroke, or was it just kind of like...
I genuinely think it was, because he just decided we just won't play through the midfield. We'll bypass midfield altogether. Let's just do that, see what happens. Because Spurs are the other team that have unpicked them this season. And I was at his press conference before the game going into Wembley, and he was genuine in his praise of Spurs, and there was a slight fear there, which I've not seen in him before. So he has to do something. They were the team capable of wrecking the double dream, and he got it right. He just played long balls. That's why he played Batshuayi, because he could hold the ball up, which he did in a sort of understated, functional way. Absolute masterstroke. Spurs did not adapt. They kept pressing. They kept the space behind them. Chelsea exploited it. Boom. There you go. That's how you win a semi-final against a team that were arguably playing the better football.
You know, you bring in a player like Willian, who's, you know, been one of Chelsea's best players in previous seasons, have been relatively underused this season, and you, as a manager, I guess you've seen enough on the training ground, you've seen enough of his performance, you know, you've seen enough from his psychology that you know if you trust him in a game like this, he's going to step up, and he certainly did that.
I don't know, you guys. I mean, much as I'd love to praise Conte here, I kind of go by what I saw on the pitch, and I saw, you know, it did feel to me like Conte's attitude was like, all right, I need Hazard because he's my best player for the run-in. I need Diego Costa, even though he's been awful for a long time, but I trust him more than Batshuayi. I'm just going to keep these guys on the bench, and then if we're killing Spurs, I don't need to bring them on. If we're getting killed, I don't need to bring them on. And if the game's in the balance, maybe I bring them on and see what they can do, because ultimately I don't particularly care as much about the FA Cup as I do about hanging on and making sure we win a league title. This is a person who is obsessed with winning and working and so on, but he also, I think, has a clear hierarchy of priorities, and winning the Premier League is his priority. By the same token, are we being unkind a little bit to Tottenham here? I mean, in the end, the reason that it was 2-2 and there was still a game in the balance for Hazard and Costa to come into is because of a free kick, which isn't necessarily genius strategic planning by the manager, and a really, really stupid penalty given away by Heung-Min Son, right? I mean, otherwise, Spurs are walking this, right? Am I wrong here? I mean, did you guys see Chelsea create tons of chances, James?
No, but I think there was that sort of that rather heated debate between Alan Shearer and Jermaine Genius at the end of the game over whether Spurs had deserved to win and whether Chelsea were lucky. And, you know, certainly Spurs, they had maybe more of the balance of play, and there were times when they really had Chelsea pinned in their own half. But I think there's a difference between weathering spells of pressure and playing a lot of the game on the back foot and playing poorly. And I actually thought Chelsea defended generally pretty well. I thought Luiz was excellent again. And you know, you could equally say about Tottenham's goals that, you know, the second one was, you know, a brilliant, indefensible,
ridiculous
pass
from
by
Christian
Eriksen. I thought Tottenham played well, but I just don't think that Chelsea didn't deserve to win.
Dicko, do we blame Pochettino for not fixing things after Hazard and Costa came on?
Do we blame him?
Matt Hughes seems to.
Yeah, well, there's always more that a coach can do, I'm sure. But equally, yes, if you're throwing on someone like Hazard, then you're throwing on, well, potentially the Football Writers Player of the Year, if not the Players Player of the Year. So, you know.
But Tottenham threw on Kyle Walker and Georges Nkoudou.
I mean, I think
they were thrown on Vincent Janssen as well.
There were bigger issues, to be honest. As much issues to be asked about the way he set up at the start, wasn't there? With Son at wing back being run ragged, the penalty obviously being drawn into a rash tackle like that, being played into such an unfamiliar position. You know, you're not surprised players make errors like that because they're either, you know, they're uncertain, they've been put into unfamiliar situations. That was, you know, just the obvious sort of, what was he thinking there, decision of the day.
Alison, that's a really good point, actually, I think, that Dicko made. I mean, we've seen, weirdly, both North London managers, both foreigners, I might add, go and make weirdo or unusual tactical choices in terms of personnel. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, that works out. Wenger's a genius. This guy puts Heung-Min Son, who incidentally was on fire and doing really well in his old position, into a wing-back role, and it completely backfires, and it's terrible. Do managers, is this the case where we point at them and be like, haha, stay in your lane, don't try to be so clever?
positionally, he looked out of his depth. But you can only assume they practiced this, and in training, he looked capable of doing it.
They practiced it for what? Like for 2 days amongst yourselves?
Yeah, I know. It's very easy to laugh at it because his tackle was... Well, his tackle was quite poor and it was very costly. But Pochettino does take risks and asks players to do probably what his defining negative characteristic, Pochettino, is that he expects a lot of young players, and maybe he expected too much in this instance against a very well-organised, well-coached Chelsea team.
Dico, you get the final word here because you get the final assessment of Pochettino, because it seems to me that Spurs have played, in fact, I think somebody's actually said that, you know, they've been the best team in the Premier League for the past 18 months cumulatively or whatever, and he's this manager who seems to be on the cusp of greatness, with teams linking him to Barcelona, and he linked himself to United, of course, last year when he had lunch with Sir Alex Ferguson. He's got this massive long-term contract. Does this damage the Pochettino brand? Is there... Or is this just a stupid knee-jerk reaction to a defeat?
I can't. I mean, by me, as you say, I go with the first half of your question more than the second. I mean, the fact is they're second in the league. They pushed Leicester closer than anyone else last season. I don't think they're going to win the league this year, but they're fighting for the title in a league when they're their wage bill, every other sort of revenue stream is fifth in the league, is it? So, you know, they're punching above their weight, and they're punching above their weight often with young English players, which is uplifting for an awful lot of us, and they're doing it with good football, well-coached, improving players. I mean, they're ticking pretty much every box apart from nailing a trophy or two more, and this was, hugely disappointing for them, but they're up against a pretty formidable team, and a team that was sticking in goals like Matic's as well. So, you know, not a great day, but I think Pochettino, the idea that we should sort of dismiss them as Spursy or say that Pochettino is not quite delivering would be hugely harsh given the strides they've made.
Is he one of the top three managers in the Premier League, Dicko?
Top three? Ooh, blimey. Put it this way, he's performing...
He's going to avoid the question. On form,
as the last 2 years, he is as good as anyone. I mean, he's the range of what he's doing that is so pleasing. You know, you can see the thing I think I always come back to is, you know, we look at league tables, we look at results, but are players improving? Are players learning? Does it look like a place that you would love to be there day to day? And blimey, Spurs just looks as good as anywhere for that.
Can you guys come up with more than two managers you'd rather have coaching the team you support than Pochettino?
I think he has to be in the top three managers, okay. Doesn't he?
I want to ask you who the other two are, because I don't want to, but that's fine. So, but you've got him in your top three, yeah?
Yeah, clearly. Absolutely.
Yeah. Alison?
Yeah, it'd be a bit weird not to, wouldn't it? I mean, they are second in the table.
So your top three presumably would be Koeman, Pochettino and Klopp, right?
No, I think Conte is the best coach of the season.
No, managers you'd want... It's not the benchmark. Managers you would
fond
want managing
of?
Your
managers
team.
Managers I like.
Managers you would want frilly, managing your team.
Managers I want managing my team. I'm happy with Klopp managing my team. Thank
right.
you.
Okay, well, what if Klopp were kidnapped by aliens?
I'd want probably Pochettino.
Pochettino's happy. I mean, he's very welcome at Cambridge United anytime he likes, however well he's doing currently under Mr. Derry. But anyway, that's another story.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Premier League PFA Player of the Year Award. I'm going to say this. This is a stupid award. We've all been through the stories of why this is a stupid award. I don't have a problem with people choosing their peers. I have a major problem with the timing of this. The first ballots go out in early February when there's more than a third of the season left. In the past, we've had ex-pros on this and elsewhere telling us all these crazy, possibly apocryphal, but certainly very believable stories of players just, you know, drawing giant phalluses on the ballot, or sometimes a PFA rep in frustration because everybody's ignoring him going and filling out all 25 ballots himself. But the main problem is the timing of it. But regardless, N'Golo Kanté wins it this year. Everybody happy with that?
It's hard to argue with it, isn't it? I mean, it's like the Oscars, you know. If you miss out on the Best Actor award 1 year and everyone thinks it was damn fine film, and then you do it again the next year, you're just going to get the award. He's been integral in one title win and one probable title win. And do the flip side, Gab, of all the negative that comes out of this award. On the plus side, if you ask players why they voted for a particular player, it is interesting because they basically say the players that they want to laud the players who have gifts they have not got themselves, or the players that just found it really, really hard to come up against. And they would have found it very hard to cope with Kanté because he's just, 1 minute he's 20 yards away and the next minute he's there getting the ball off you. That must be incredibly irritating. And he's always makes Chelsea look like they've got 12 players on the pitch, which is staggering feat, staggering achievement. So I think he does. I don't think it's a controversial win at all.
Dicko, no controversy for you?
Well, there's debate to be had. I mean, if you're asking me who has sort of lifted me off my seat most, it would probably be Hazard. And he's, yeah, at times I just thought he was, you know, close to that sort of unplayable level this season that, you know, very few footballers get to. Equally, Kanté, you know, I know we're judging it on one season, but it's pretty hard to sort of forget what the context of him coming from Leicester as well, coming to a big club, instantly stepping up. I'm told we like to vote for people we like as well. I'm told by all that have ever dealt with him that he is just immensely likable, immensely humble, decent guy as well, which is no bad thing. So I'm certainly not going to sort of, you know, argue against it, even though the voting forms have just come through for the SWA one, and I think I'll end up tossing a coin between him and Hazard. Dele Alli could well be in the mix, as could others.
But at least you have the luxury that if Dele Alli scores a hat-trick between now and the end of the season and Spurs go and win the Premier League...
Oh, the timing's crackers.
You're going to change your vote to Dele Alli, presumably, right?
No. You've got to judge out of the season, but it's ridiculous that at the time when, you know, the stakes are highest, the games are carrying ever more import week after week, it's ridiculous to go, you know, just at the point where the season is sort of, you know, at its most poised and fascinating, you know.
Now, here's something that I find interesting about the PFA award, having looked back at its history, and I'll direct the question to you, James. What I found fascinating is, since Paul McGraw won it, only two players who were not strikers or attacking midfielders have won it. One was John Terry, obviously captained Mourinho's Chelsea in 2004-05. The other one was Roy Keane. Everybody else has been attacking midfielder or a striker. Now, I chalk this down to footballers, short attention span, don't really watch football on TV, a lot of them, see the highlights, blah, blah, blah. But then I looked at the early years of this award, which I believe was in the early 70s, and the first two winners, Bite Your Legs, Norman Hunter and Colin Todd, both nasty center backs. The next two winners were goalkeepers. So you really don't have this legacy. It just seems that, it seems stupid asking you because you weren't around for it, but is there a change in terms of what people appreciate?
I think it's a really interesting point. I don't know if it's kind of a change in how we see things, although that what you've just said would maybe suggest that it is. Year on year, we have this, and we kind of have it with the Ballon d'Or as well, although you could argue that Messi and Ronaldo are so exceptional. Nonetheless, it does kind of feel like, I don't know for what reason, maybe because it's because goals are so paramount that, you know, goal scorers are always going to be the kind of more obvious choice. But I think awards like these do seem to sort of consistently bias towards one facet of the game at the expense of the other. And, you know, witness the derision heaped on poor Roy Hodgson when he dared to cast his Ballon d'Or vote for Javier Mascherano. And I think it kind of says something about how exceptional Kante has been, that he has made himself the, you know, consensus choice for Player of the Year. I mean, I think he was a heavy favourite, and maybe, you know, people thought Hazard, but I think, you know, he was pretty much a kind of a very uncontroversial winner in this climate where, you know, basically defensive players generally don't get the recognition. It kind of shows you how exceptional he's been.
I know Alisson's favourite player growing up was a winger, and a very talented attacking winger at that. One Stevie Highway, right?
Right.
Dicko, who was your favourite player growing up?
Oh, God, memory lane.
But please don't mention some guy who played for Cambridge United never heard of. Just
your
favourite player we would have, you know, plausibly heard of.
If you only know that, it was, well, Kevin Keegan until I met him. No, that's been a bit harsh, but I did once queue up for his autograph, and he was really, really grumpy. I would say, so if that spoiled it a little bit for me. It's funny, autograph hunting is a revealing process. But Brian Robson, I would probably say, was certainly up there. I saw him play at, I think it was Stamford Bridge once when I was a teenager, and he just blew me away, the classic British sort of warrior player with an immense skill on top. He was fantastic.
I just want to ask you that, just because I'm going to digress here, but I can do that. Who do you think was more gifted, Brian Robson or Roy Keane? And I think back here, of course, to early Roy Keane as well.
Wow, good question. Yeah, okay. I mean, Robson has shot on him. Good question. I think Robson might be more versatile as a player, and I'd say Keane has something elemental about him, didn't he? That was just almost off the scale at times in terms of just the will. I mean, Robson didn't lack for that, but Keane was almost insanely driven. Who would you choose? Yeah, who would you choose for a night out? That's an even bigger question.
Alisson, I'm going to put a theory to you about this attacking, defending thing. And it goes back to the number of people I've met who tell me that Duncan Edwards, England would have definitely won the World Cup in 66 with Duncan Edwards as captain. Duncan Edwards is the greatest player ever and stuff. And then you look at, you know, he was tragically died very young. And I think other than Brian Glanville, I kind of feel that nobody's ever actually seen this guy play. Could it be that in the 1970s and 80s, because there was less, obviously there was less coverage of football, when it came to defenders, and defenders all make mistakes, and the difference is defensive mistakes lead to goals, in the same way strikers make mistakes, but then strikers score goals, so we forget about it, that it was easier, not just in England, but around the world, to create sort of this myth of the infallible defender, the defensive colossus, Bobby Moore never getting it wrong, and so on, because there's only one game on television every year. Whereas now, even the very best defenders, you know, people will make one mistake every couple games, even the very best ones, because they're humans. And when a striker makes a mistake, we just move on, and 3 minutes later they shoot again and score, and everything's fine again. Could it be a little bit of that?
Yeah, there's a lot of that, I think. But I think it's also, if we're talking about things that are voted upon, and I think when you come to the crunch and you put your tick next to somebody's name, you will probably end up thinking, that player does things I cannot do. everyone thinks they're capable of, you know, running in, running a lot, blocking tackles, making tackles, trying to be destructive, but not, you know, deep down you can't do those sort of balletic runs or that surge of pace that and place the ball exactly where you want to. Those moments of magic, there's just more magic in being an attacking player, and it's just when you come to put the tick next to somebody, you're probably going to be swayed by the moments that made your hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and that doesn't happen very often when you're watching a defender, probably. That's all there is to it.
And in English players in the 1970s didn't actually watch football other than the games they played in, and so that's why they thought that Colin Todd had these magical powers and nobody else in England could match.
Well, I think you saw less football and you probably knew that good teams were built on just being a team and being defensive, and we were into our leaders a lot more, and they were usually your centre halves, and there was just something more heroic about them, possibly. Yeah. Right.
Speaking of heroic, we just had the Champions League semi-final draw. We have a Madrid derby, Real Madrid against Atletico, and Monaco against Juventus, which is also sort of geographically kind of a derby, not very far from each other. Dico, are you excited for these semi-finals?
I think so, yeah. I think, Monaco have been, the way they played, I was lucky enough to be at the chaotic game against City and was gripped to the second leg as well. I thought so, and hugely exciting. I mean, the way they play, the flair that they've got is great. I think the Madrid derby, there's a slight sense of we've been there before, but obviously the intensity is going to be huge yet again. So, you know, it's going to have that quality. So yeah, no, I mean, I think plenty to enjoy. I just find Champions League semi-finals at this stage, you sort of rarely feel let down, don't you? Just because the stakes are high, teams chasing a bit of history, or in Monaco's case, trying to do something a bit different. And I'll be watching.
It's rare for a team to get to the Champions League semi-final without impressing, but I think all the teams in it have been incredibly impressive. I mean, like Dico, I've been really seduced by Monaco this season. I mean, I was at the game where they beat Tottenham in the group stages, and it was only 2-1, but it could have been 4-5-1.
Pochettino again? He is, isn't he?
Yes.
You are you?
I tell you what, I'm praising Jardim instead. That's what I'm doing, because I think he's an absolutely superb coach. What he's done with Monaco this season, a team with no real kind of obvious superstar players, to turn them into arguably the best attacking side in Europe, I think has been a phenomenal coaching achievement.
Right, Mel Falcao, by the way, thanks you.
But he's not exactly coming off. He wasn't exactly coming off a good couple of seasons, was he?
The man was injured, but it's a great point about Jardim, because especially when you think that Monaco, in previous years, was actually a pretty defensive side, even under Jardim. So he's kind of shown that he can do both ends, which in a way Juventus, I think, have also shown that they can do both ends. Alison, do you miss English clubs? Does it diminish your enjoyment?
Oh, I've got used to it. No, it doesn't diminish it, although I did have a theory that Leicester wouldn't, at the start of the season, Leicester wouldn't do that well in the Premier League, I think, you know, and most people, even Ranieri, said it would be a tricky season. But I did think they'd be addicted to fairy tales and that they would win a cup competition. So I did think they might actually make the final of the Champions League. In the narrative sense, I think the most amazing story would have been for Leicester to have continued yet another fairy tale. But that aside, as long as there's variety in the semi-final lineup, and there is, I mean, you've got four clubs there with such different approaches and styles of play and history, I think it's an amazing semi-final lineup, and I think probably most neutrals will root for Monaco simply because they just seem to say, hey, we'll just try and score more than you.
I do wonder though, if Real Madrid win it again, 3 wins in 4 years, are we going to have to reevaluate a lot of things, such as all the criticism that we've directed at Florentino Perez, especially me, such as the fact that, oh, you need experience, blah, 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 great players don't make good managers, yada, yada, yada. All this stuff, that all these true footballing truisms that we've thrown out there, is Zidane going to go and subvert all that? Does it actually become, if you've got the best players in the world, and I think Real Madrid have the best players in the world by some margin at this stage, even with Gareth Bale on one leg. I don't know. I just wonder, maybe we take a step back, or maybe we've overrated the role of the manager. Maybe we shouldn't be chucking all this money at your Pep Guardiolas and your Jurgen Klopps, because they don't have the manpower. They don't have the manpower. All right, enough of this bloviating by me. How about some quick hits instead? Anthony Martial shines as Manchester United win away to Bournemouth to make it 23 unbeaten in the Premier League. Dicko, do you want to comment on their top four hopes, or tell me whether we really should have been seeing much more from Anthony Martial this season, because he's actually pretty good, or maybe even both?
Top four hopes, Thursday night, the Manchester derby. Are we going? Fascinating game. Martial, I think we wish we had seen more of him, but just because he's got a bit of pace and flair and excitement. But Mourinho likes players who conform to his views, and Martial's clearly had a bit of learning to do on that. So you don't cross Jose.
Crystal Palace win again away to Liverpool. That's 19 of a possible 24 points in Big Sam's last 8 games. James, does stuff like this leave you wondering what might have been England-wise, since you're a big England fan, if not for that pint of wine keynote speaker incident?
I mean, it kind of has to, doesn't it? I mean, I wasn't kind of a massive proponent of Allardyce for England, but we kind of oscillate with England managers, don't we? We oscillate between, I just want someone to, you know, make the most of our limited resources, accept that we're not a great team and make us hard to beat, and, oh, I just want us to play great football even if we lose. For the former option, you kind of had to be intrigued by what Allardyce would have done, but we'll never know.
Speaking of that game at Anfield, Alisson, qualified ref, there was an incident when Coutinho was clearly fouled by former Liverpool player turned Judas, Martin Kelly, stayed on his feet and failed to score. Now, do you blame Coutinho for not going down, or do you actually blame the referee for not calling it back and awarding the penalty, because he was clearly fouled?
Yeah, this is something I think referees need to work on. They need to, as a group, decide that they are going to award penalties where a player hasn't fallen down but could easily have done so, because that way it's a big step in eradicating diving. So you bring in retrospective analysis for diving, which I'm slightly uncomfortable with, because it's not always clear that you can know it's a dive. But if you take away the motivation to dive in the first place because you know you're going to be rewarded, then that has to be the best step to getting rid of something we all hate so much.
Dicko, quick aside on this one. You and I are brothers in the VAR cause. This would have been reviewable by VAR, right?
It would have been. I mean, this is where we're in that classic grey area of the way it's been set up, is that the VAR will only intervene if the referee has made a clear mistake. So would this qualify as a clear mistake? Debatable. This is why we're trying out experiments. I think this one would end up possibly falling in the, you know, people who worry that we're not going to have anything to debate about, they shouldn't, because this might have fallen into a grey area, and there's going to be plenty of grey areas.
Middlesbrough travel to Bournemouth, who were supposed to be on the beach, and they get spanked 4-0. Dicko, they're done now, right?
They are done, on points, on momentum, on everything else. So I think George can welcome Newcastle up, I think, this evening, can't they? So, which is a relief for him, because Sunderland are gone and Middlesbrough are gone. So at least he's got the tune back to keep him in daily work in the Premier League.
Marco Silva has to play with 10 men for over an hour for another bad decision. And Hull still go out and defeat Watford 2-0. James, when you look at his resources and what he's achieved, he really is the magic man, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, you look at his home record.
He's got the silver touch.
The silver touch. You look at his home record going back through his time at Olympiacos, right the way back to his time at Estoril. It's absolutely incredible. I think what Hull actually did really well and went slightly under the radar was they bought very well in January. They bought very good players. You know, Ranocchia has got 30-odd Italy caps, hasn't he? Grzycki scored. Do you not like Ranocchia?
I like him as a person. We could spend a whole debate about him. He is somebody with a hugely unusual set of skills whose confidence was completely destroyed and had basically been horrendous on the pitch for 3 years. He's obviously seized the opportunity. Well done to him.
Mm. And Krasicki is a player who's always impressed me whenever I've seen him play for Poland in international tournaments. Markovic is clearly a player of some talent, but they're all players who I think traditionally people would have thought, oh no, buy players who've got Premier League experience, you know, don't go for these sorts of players. And Hull did it, and I think it's massively paid off.
I think at some point the story of how Hull ran their transfer business in January is going to fully come out, and people might appreciate Marco Silva even more. Let's not write off Swansea either. Alison, I have a soft spot for Fernando Llorente. You've got one for Gylfi Sigurdsson. We both have a soft spot for Paul Clement. They did the job against Stoke. Should they keep hope alive?
Well, they have to, don't they? It's really tough. It's not in their own hands. They have to hope that Hull slip up a bit more than they do. But there was a fantastic atmosphere. I was there at the Liberty Stadium on Saturday. Amazing atmosphere, a real sense of belief. Leon Britton bought every single member of the squad a DVD of the Swansea story, told them to watch it. He said most of them seemed to have done so.
What did you do, quiz them afterwards?
I said, did you test them? He said, I don't think that had gone down very well, but they did mention little snippets from the films which proved they'd watched it. Because, you know, in 2001, they were spiralling out of business and a group of fans got together to make sure that didn't happen. The trouble is, Hull have got momentum too. So it's going to be... Leon Britton said the best they can hope for is it goes to the wire, and that is the best they can hope for. And I have a question for you, Gab, surprise, surprise, is all about the Clásico and how come Lionel Messi seems to play even better when he's got a little hanky stuck up his lip?
The remarkable thing about this game, which Barcelona won, I mean, this is probably the best Clásico in years, certainly for the neutral. You had up and down, you had everything going on, you had Gareth Bale getting injured early, James Rodriguez coming on to make it 2-2 after Sergio Ramos had been sent off, 10-man Madrid battling back. And then you had this incredible finale where Messi, having scored an exceptional goal, I thought, for the opener, which, by the way, was vintage Barcelona goal, something like 18 touches, 8 players involved, boom, boom, boom. But that was, weirdly, that was possibly the worst of the 3 goals, because Rakitic had one of those long-range rockets, which you guys all seem to love in this country. And then the final goal, Messi sprinting across the pitch, counterattack, literally just about the last kick of the game to win it 3-2. Absolutely stunning, exhausting. Sergio Ramos now has 5 red cards in a Clásico, 22 red cards in his career. Surreal how you can be one of the best defenders in the world with that kind of record, but bizarrely, I think he is. And Zinedine Zidane will go back and wonder if maybe playing Bale was a mistake, and then substituting when he got injured, sending on Asensio, was maybe even more of a mistake instead of Isco, who I wrote about in the game this week. And you should all read that column, even though he didn't get to play a single minute in that game. Barcelona are now level on points. Real Madrid have a game in hand. I don't know. I mean, this might possibly go down to the wire when you consider that Real Madrid will necessarily, to some degree, prioritise the Champions League.
And the sad thing is, it clashed with A Line of Duty on BBC One.
There's this thing they've invented called iPlayer.
No. There is always one programme per season you have to watch live with the nation, and Line of Duty is that programme.
You do not own a telephone? You could find 2 screens, you could watch both.
No, there is one programme per season that you have to watch and give your undivided attention to.
Line of Duty only lasts an hour, right?
Yeah, but it lasted the final hour of the Clásico.
Okay, but then after that, you go back and you flip back to the Clásico. And
but that's not as good, not live either.
This is true.
Very difficult evening, Gab, for most people, I think, making that choice.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guest today, Matt Dickinson, who ran a marathon in a choo-choo yesterday and lived to tell the tale while raising a lot of money for an important cause. Alison Rudd, who did not but got to watch Line of Duty, and the only living Gearbrandt in captivity, James. Remember, you can sign up to our newspaper. It's just £12 for a 12-week trial. You get all sorts of goodies, including video highlights. That's right, you don't need to go and watch Match of the Day. If you don't want to, you can just sit and watch our little highlight clips instead, should you so choose. And it's not just Premier League highlights, it's Champions League highlights as well. So please press that subscribe button on wherever you choose to download your podcast, because of course you can also subscribe to our podcast, and you can leave us a review on iTunes. If it's a good review, it'll help people find us, and we will grow as a tribe of game podcast listeners. If it's a bad review, then a puppy will die. So please don't leave one. Till next time, bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts. Calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.